Antium, let's just say that, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. Okay, the next day, we put in at Sidon. So that's our cure. Sorry, I'm going to just go here. I don't have a laser pointer for some reason. Okay, here, Sidon. Okay? So they've been moving, they're porting, they're just traveling along the coast, trying to get to Rome, because Paul basically made his case, and now he's being sent to Rome. And from there, Julius treated Paul kindly, the soldier, and gave him time to hang out with his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. Oh, that's so cool. How do you use this? Oh, green line? Ooh. Ooh. Okay. No, I won't point at other people. The lee of Cyprus. So what's the lee? The lee is kind of like where there's no wind. So wherever there's no wind, no issues, they would go that way. And so they sailed under the lee of Cyprus, which is around this corner, so they wouldn't hit the winds in the open sea, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra and Lycia, which is right, my hands are shaking, I don't know why. Okay, here, right there. And then there, the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. So there was a ship that was supposed to go from here to Italy, and but the way they do it is they go this way, because it's safer, rather than crossing the open sea sometimes. And for some reason, it was here getting grain, and that's usually what they used to do, okay? And we were sailing slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, which is right here at the edge. So it slowed down. It was delayed. And during that time, the wind did not allow us to go further. We sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which the city, which was the city of Lycia. So right here, or Lycia, or right here. So they're sailing. They get delayed here. And then somehow they decide to go this way, which is supposed to circumvent a lot of the craziness of this area. And so what happens is, since much time has passed, and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over. So what happened was, as they were traveling, it got so delayed, they actually hit a point where it was actually dangerous to keep going. Because the fast at that time would have been around October. And by the time October comes around, late October in 59, 60, that's what they approximate the date, that would have been the worst time to travel in the Mediterranean. The storms would have been a lot crazier. The weather conditions were just not conducive. Most people would winter. That means they would stay for 3 or 4 months before, and once the winds die down, this winter season passes, it's usually more calmer in the air. So this is actually still true today. I was reading a Coast Guard's account of that area, and he kind of wrote about how Paul's writing is very true about that area and that time. So it's very interesting, all the details you see. And then it says here, we kind of go, then we zoom into the story. They're on the ship, and since much time had passed, the voyage was now dangerous because it was over. And Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and of the ship, but also of our lives." And he's saying, it's risky. But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. So the soldier listened to the people that were on the board because they wanted to make money. And because the harbor was not suitable, they decided to go from there and try to reach this place called Phoenix, which is right here. You see that little spot right here? Phoenix, not Arizona. And a harbor of Crete facing both southwest and northwest and spend the winter. So they wanted to get as far forward as they can and settle right there. But when the south wind blew gently, they thought they could just stay along the coast traveling. They weighed an anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind called the northeaster struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. And running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, which is right there, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. And after hoisting up, they used supports to undergird the ship. And they, fearing that they would run aground on the Cirrus, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. And since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. So they started to dump all their supplies. And then on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. So they couldn't even see the sun or stars, which didn't appear for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, and all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. So you got to imagine, it is terrible. So bad, they've given up hope. They're dumping their cargo. They're dumping things they were trying to preserve to make money, right? They're dumping everything. They're trying to lighten the boat so it stays high in the water so it doesn't sink. And since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God, of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I've been told. But we must run aground on some island. And when the 14th night had come, so like 2 weeks had gone by, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, right here, okay, after midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. They were getting nervous. So they took a sounding, and they found 20 fathoms, which is the depth. A little further on, they took another, they dropped a lead weight, sounding again, and they found it 15 fathoms. And fearing that they would be, because they're going too fast, they're out of control, they're going towards the rocks, they don't want to crash the ship. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down four anchors from the stem and stern and prayed for the day to come. And so the stern of the is the back, right? They're trying to slow it down. So they're dropping anchors to slow it down. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, they lowered the ship's boat under the, in the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the boat. So basically what they did was like, oh, we're dropping anchors, but they're actually dropping a ship. Why? Because they're trying to get away. They're trying to get away. They feel like there's no hope, right? And Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. And then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. And as the day was about to go to dawn, Paul urged them all to take food. He said, today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food. It will give you strength, for not a hair will perish, is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread. He gave thanks to God in the presence of of all. He broke it and began to eat. And then they were all encouraged, and they ate some food themselves. And we were in all 276 persons in the ship. When they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. And then I'm going to stop there. It's a lot of reading. And the next part basically just says they shipwreck in this place. So they somehow make it by the storm, just takes them all the way to right here. Okay, and basically in Malta is where they settle. It's not exactly where they were hoping to be, but somehow they got there and they were safe. But they lost everything. They dropped all their, basically they even lost like some of their sails. They just dropped everything. Anything to save themselves, they had to drop it off so the ship would be as light as possible. And somehow they make it to Malta. And so that's kind of the story, Paul's journey, okay? And as you know, we've been going through Acts for the longest time, for about 2 years now. And in going through Acts, we know that Paul has been called by God to go to Rome. He's been called to go to Rome since Acts 23, where he had a dream, and basically God said, you need to take courage, for you are going to go to Rome to testify about me. And you're going to do it in Jerusalem, but you're going to do it in Rome. And we know that in the end, Paul makes it to Rome, because we know the letters that follow, Paul makes it there. He writes other letters, he writes other things from Rome. And so, why Rome was so important? Why is Rome so important? And I want you to understand, Luke, whenever we've read about Luke, Luke is a journey. This is written by Luke, the Dr. Luke, right? And he wrote the book of the Gospel of Luke and also the book of Acts. It's a two-part series to explain to someone that basically had paid for it, like a benefactor, that this is the story of Jesus. This is the story of the church, what has happened. And in the first book, in Luke, it talks and almost insists that Jesus needs to get to Jerusalem. There's a traveling and journeying of Jesus to Jerusalem. And then you get, in Acts, you get the church needs to eventually end up in Rome. But why Rome? Why Rome? And the reason why Rome is because Rome, to them at that point, was the center of the world. It was the place where all the world met, where all the world collided. And it's interesting when they said Rome, because I was reading a document recently where like in ancient China, like 300-something AD, they had sent like emissaries from China, had ended up in Rome, and they basically write about the Rome being a small little town or city. It's very interesting. And so you see there's a connection that Rome itself was a seat of the Greco-Roman world. And so if you get there, you would get to the world, basically. You would be exposed to the world. And so it's important. So in Acts, Paul getting to Rome is almost like the message that God's message is meant to go to the world. It's meant to go to the world. And so, but today, but we've been going through this journey where nothing good has happened to Paul. Paul's been in prison. He's been questioned. He's unjustly treated. He's sent out. He's being held for no reason, basically. And then he appeals to Caesar, and he's being sent off, and nothing positive happens. And throughout all this thing, God tells him, you're going to get to Rome one day. But the problem is he hasn't got there yet. And it's like the most difficult, hard journey to take to get there. And so why does that matter to us today? Why does that matter? And I'll say today we're going to look at it's the storms. Like what about storms is special? What can we learn from the storm that happens to Paul? And also, like, how does the sea play a role in this, right? And I want you to understand that the Jewish community, the Jewish people, they were not a people that were very ocean-based, right? All their ocean base is not, there's no ocean, there's this lake, right? Or sea, Sea of Galilee. But they're not known for their ship skills, right? And it's to the Jewish culture and to many other cultures then, the sea was mysterious. It's chaotic. And especially to the Jewish people, it was unknown. It was an unknown fact thing. It was because they were not seafaring people. They didn't have much background. It was out of their control. And so when we read this story today, what's really interesting, historians will use it to kind of show you how detailed Luke was. Because Luke must have been there. Because whoever was being interviewed for this book would have been Paul or Luke because they were present. Or maybe those people that were on the ship. And there's a lot of little references to like things like we in verse there's a verse here that says we, and you can tell Luke is there. It's happening. He's remembering what happened on the boat, and they were afraid, and what Paul said. And so I want you to see that there's an eyewitness account to it. And in this thing, there's this huge wind that comes northeaster. And they know that there's a reputation for this northeaster wind that comes from the north down to the east. It comes down from the mountains and off Crete. And it's a very strong wind that can move ships out of control. And so all these little details, it gives you a really good painting of what's going on, and it's actually pretty accurate historically. And I just wanted to point that out because I'm kind of a nerd about it. When I start reading about stuff like that, I had to read all about ships and study it for like a week. So I did that, and it was a lot of fun. But so I wanted to convey how interesting it was to you by walking you through the journey. But I think especially today, this idea of storms is something that I think we can learn a lot from. And so I offer to you 3 points to think about the storm today. And the first thing is, when we encounter storms in our lives, there is always a dilemma that we face, a dilemma of a storm, okay? But also, storms often serve a purpose. Storms serve a purpose. And lastly, that often in storms we find a place of peace, okay? So dilemma, purpose, peace, okay? There's dilemma that we face when we encounter storms. There is an element of the purpose of a storm. And lastly, the peace that comes from a storm. And I want you guys to look today at verse 21 to 26, first of all, when we look at the dilemma of the storm, is that Paul here, okay, as things are looking really hopeless and they're in the water, this storm's happening, everyone's scared. They're so scared, they can't even eat, right? They're so stressed out, anxious, they can't even eat. And then Paul out of nowhere says, hey guys, I got bad news and I got good news. Bad news, you're not going to get all the things you want. You're not going to make money off this shipment. The ship's not going to last. But the good news is no one's going to die. Okay, no one's going to die because you know what? I was praying last night and God told me this through an angel. So don't worry. Take heart. Okay, so here Paul says, you know what? Don't worry, guys. You might not get everything you want, but God is in control and you will be safe. Okay, but then what happens? In 27 to 32, as things are getting kind of crazy, the water is getting really shallow. They're noticing they're going too fast. Right, towards the whatever they can't see what's in front of them, but they know their ship's moving too fast. So they're trying to slow it down by throwing anchors. And actually, I just want to say something off. When they do like shipwrecks, old ancient ships, they often would find anchors thrown back. Because the purpose of the smaller anchors is to slow the ship down before it runs into something. And often when they find shipwrecks, they would just look for the anchors and they just trace it down a path towards the nearest land mass, and they would find usually the ship as wrecked. It's just an interesting thing I read about in the old ancient ships. So that's what they were doing. And what happens is the sailors are so desperate. They pretend they're throwing anchors off. And you know what do they do? They're trying to get the ship off the boat so they can jump on the ship and leave, right? And somehow in that process, Paul has to intervene. He has to say, wait a second, you can't do that. You can't do that. You got to keep those people on because we need them to help us sail the boat. And the only way everyone survives is if we all stay together, right? And that brings up a question that I want you guys to think about today, okay? Is that there's this dilemma that arises in this moment that kind of throws you off. If God is in control of the situation, if he's absolutely in control of the situation, then why does Paul have to intervene and tell the soldiers they need to do something to get the sailors to stay? Why is that necessary? And because Paul seemed confident that nothing would go wrong before, right? But why all of a sudden is the sailors... must they stay on the ship? Why is that necessary? You guys see what I'm saying? There's a moment where if you're so confident, why is this necessary to keep the sailors there? And I think this is a question that often we encounter in our lives when we go through difficulties, okay, and how we face these moments. And what I'm saying is that when we face difficult times or moments that are out of our control, often it kind of makes us think of this question is, is God really in control? And how much do I have to do? Like, what must I do to respond? Like, what is my involvement if God is absolutely in control of the situation? There's this element of play between God being absolutely in control and our response and our living it out, right? And there's often this interplay when we go through things. And I think what Paul points out to us here today is that this dilemma that we face is not a dilemma, is a dilemma that we commonly face, but it's not a dilemma that we should ignore. But God is always in control. And at the same time, we still have a role to play. We have a function to play in this moment. And I think what's interesting is in the storm, though God is going to preserve the people, Paul is still an agent that must do something. He still has to act. Okay? And I think that sometimes when we encounter situations that are hard, we're going to say, oh, you know what, God, you got everything, so I don't need to do anything. I'm just going to sit back and not do anything. And I don't think that's always right. Okay? And at the same time, it isn't like we need to do everything and God has nothing to do, right? God is in control. Something must happen. And I wanted to give you a story to think about where this kind of comes up. And I'm going to do it very briefly, so write it down and look for it later. But if you've never heard the story of Esther, the story of Esther is a story that is really famous to the Jewish people. They celebrate it every year through Purim. And it's a story where a time in Israel's history, the people of Israel did not, they were exiled. They were basically a defeated people in another world, another country. And they're like subjugated. And under that subjugation, somehow in the subjugation in the Persian Empire, in the rule of King Ahasuerus, somehow a Jewish, young Jewish woman becomes the queen of Persia. For a season, she becomes the queen. And actually, in that process, the story goes, is that an evil like leader that hates the Jewish people named Haman plots to kill all the Jewish community of in the empire. And somehow in that process, in that story, God raises up Esther through her uncle and her uncle Mordecai, who is this advisor of the king. And Esther is given in face of a dilemma. And it's in Esther chapter 4 where it says, you know, who knows when what time you were made for this, right? And basically Esther was hesitant to do something to save her people. She was scared. And basically Mordecai calls her out and says, hey, who knows if God has already called you for this? He had a plan for you. And so Esther, she responds. And if you read the story, what happens is the plot is overturned because Haman, the evil guy, he gets killed. And somehow through that story, they're able to save the entire nation. And somehow, even as they survive, they become even more blessed in the process. And the story goes is that, you know, God is in the story. You never see a word of God. God is never mentioned in the story. Like, there's no mention of God doing anything, which is really cool about Esther. It's a very subtle text in the Old Testament. But in the story, the human actors are doing everything. They're all playing a part. And yet, somehow, God orchestrates every circumstance to work out perfectly to save a people group. And that's why it becomes such an important story to the people of Israel. And they know God's part of the story, okay? And in many ways, Peter even talks about this in his own story. And Peter in chapter 2 of Acts, okay, in verse 22 to 23, I think, is that it says, men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, he was preaching to a Gentile crowd, to a Jewish crowd too that was gathered. And a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs in your midst. This Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. You crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. And my point is saying is, even here, there's an element of God's plan. And yet, human agents are acting in God's plan to bring about Jesus' death. There's a choice being made. An action being made that happens that leads to the murder of these people. So my point of trying to bring this all together is just saying there's an element of God being completely in control, having a plan, and yet there's this huge space where we are interacting with the circumstance. And I think often when we face hardships or storms, this is something that we have to wrestle with, is what is our role, and at the same time, what is God doing? And I think it's really hard for us to hear this because, and the reason I made it the first point is because when we go through hard stuff, we often ask God, why did this happen, right? And we're trying to figure out, is this part of God's plan? Is it not part of God's plan? And how should I respond? And you guys know I've been going through cancer, and I do like using the cancer card for a lot of things, but in preaching and stuff, I want to share, like, it does change kind of the things, the way you look at things. And this week, I wanted to share a story that kind of ties to it. A friend of mine named Edward, I asked him first, so he said it's okay to share his name. His name's Edward, but we have a nickname for him because he's like a big guy, and bigger than me. And Edward and I, we haven't talked for like 10 years, 15 years. We lost touch. We follow each other's lives, but we don't really talk. But in cancer, we started writing to each other and talking. And over the last 4 months, Edward has kind of found his faith. He's been going to church. He's becoming someone that's seeking God. And in the process is because we both started talking about our struggle with illness. He's going through health issues, and those have caused him a lot of pain and discomfort, and it's led him astray. But the last 15 years for him and me, we stopped really talking because I kind of started, I got really active in church, and I moved away from hanging out with my old crowd of really rich Taiwanese guys and friends. And Edward, he's from a really rich background. He's a great guy. He's a great guy, and he used to love to, like, have fun and do a lot of things. And, you know, we were talking about our past, and he kind of shared how he wished that things were a little bit different, how he approached things. And I looked at him, I agreed with him. I said, yeah, you know, if we had come to God earlier, both of us, maybe this wouldn't have happened, right? But in the process, we realized that we don't really know what would have happened if we did choose God earlier or not. But the one thing we do know is that those experiences have shaped us to be who we are. You know, the fact that he knows seeking God now is a special thing. It's beautiful. It's amazing. He's inviting his friends. He's been such a great friend to so many people. And so we're reflecting. We realize in the moment, when we were in those moments, we thought everything we were doing was for the best of us. We thought, you know what? It doesn't matter what other people think, you know? I know what's best for my life. But in retrospect, we look and go, man, maybe God had a bigger plan than we understood, because when we were having all that fun, it probably wasn't the best thing for us, life choice-wise and health-wise and everything. And that's what I'm sharing, is that it may seem like God has no plan for you right now, or you might disagree with his view of things, but sometimes the bigger picture is much bigger than you would understand, right? And I think in Edward's story and our story, as we reflected, was that our terrible choices sometimes that have led us to regret things, sometimes they've been actually vehicles for us to have become who we become today. So we actually played a role. Our choices didn't help us eventually get there. And so the sailors here felt they couldn't do anything anymore. But Paul knew, no matter what, we need to stay together because God is in control. God is still in control, but yet we need to stay together. And so he had to tell the soldiers, cut the ropes on the ship, drop it in the water, leave the ship. We don't need that ship. And somehow, because of it all, they survive. So I know I'm going kind of slow. I'll go faster, okay? So the first point is that there's always this dilemma. Our actions and how much God is working. And I think the reason I'm talking about storms today is because when I'm reading this text, I know when we try to read it faithfully, and often we still read our biases, our experiences into the text. And for me, when I read this, it speaks to me much about how God is working through the storms of our lives. He works through the storms of our lives to teach us a lot of things. And the first thing we often face when we face these storms, whatever it is, I don't know your story, not all your stories, but I know we all have all faced hardships. In those stories, we often wonder, is God, are you really doing this for something better? Or the other question we might think is, why does it matter what I do then? You know, and that's the first question we think of. But the second one, I think, is why? What is the purpose of storms? Why do they happen in our lives? And I'll give you two reasons why I think they happen. First of all, it's for his glory. It's always for his glory. It is always for God's glory. Because ultimately, when for God's glory, it brings about his good, okay? His good. But the second thing is that it's for our good, for our godliness. It shapes us, it develops us, and molds us. Now, I'm going to first talk about for his glory, what that looks like. Because when you think of for his glory, a really famous text that we have to consider is the one in Genesis 37 to 50. There's a story in the beginning of the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the very first book, about this father named Jacob. Jacob has 12 children. His favorite is his, one of his younger ones. His name is Joseph. It was his favorite. And he had favoritism. He loved his son most, and his son was kind of a punk, right? He had, father made him a special cloak. He would have these dreams. He would have these visions, and he would tell his brothers, like, dude, you're going to bow down to me one day. And the brother's like, what? And they get mad. They get filled with jealousy. And over time, they plot, and they end up plotting and selling and beating up Joseph and selling him into slavery. And in the story, it's like hopeless. Joseph's story goes further and further away from God. It goes further and further away from any hope. He's a slave, and somehow, as being a slave, he becomes favored. But in the favoritism, the owner's wife tries to hit on him, tries to sleep with him, and then he refuses. But somehow, you know, she grabs his clothes and pulls it off him, I'm butchering the story, so you have to read it. It's in Genesis, okay? But then somehow he gets thrown in jail for it because the boss blames him, right? Because she lies to her husband, says, hey, dude, he was trying to, like, attack me physically. And he was like, no, I didn't do that. But then it doesn't matter. He's thrown in prison. And in prison, he meets these two people, right? Over the years, he's stuck in prison. He meets these two people that are the king's baker and the king's cupbearer. And he can interpret dreams. He can read dreams. And he has this dream for the baker and the cupbearer, and he interprets for them. And then it ends up happening. It's true, right? One of them dies, one of them lives. But they forget to tell the king when they become restored. Well, one of them becomes restored, that this guy is in prison that can do things. But one day the king needs help for a dream that he has. Nobody can answer this dream. And Joseph is remembered by the cupbearer, I believe. And the cupbearer somehow gets Joseph an audience. And Joseph basically aces the test. He is able to read the dream. He prepares Egypt to go through years of famine and abundance, how to plan. And he becomes like the top leader to the king of Egypt, like an equal, like a governor, like a prime minister. Okay? And somehow in that process, all that story, ups and downs it goes, Joseph ends up in the most powerful position to serve the country. And what happens is his family, as they're going, the whole country goes through 7 years of famine, the area goes through famine. Somehow his family members end up in his court begging for food. They need help. And Joseph, in that process, reunites with his family. Okay? And what he says at the very end is really special. He says, you, in verse chapter 50, at the very last chapter, in verse 20, Joseph says to his brothers, he says, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. And I want to say this to you guys, that in the story, ultimately, something that evil that looked so hopeless turns out to be an opportunity for great good to happen, great redemption to happen. And that is often how I see God working in our world. That we might see things in the present tense as difficult, impossible, hard, but God often sees those as things that he can redeem, that he has redeemed. And we're going to skip the Romans verse, so keep moving. Okay, I was going to share from Romans and talk about Romans, but we're just going to stop here, okay? And the thing about it is that it's not that there's no evil in this world, that there's no injustices, and there's not bad things that happen, or that we haven't seen people go through incredibly difficult moments, but often is that God often is able to accomplish something far greater and good that is exactly opposite to what the evil intended. And what I mean is we have evil happening, and then God somehow always brings it to something good. In the grand scheme, makes it good. And in the story of Job, which is something I've been reading a lot lately, is that the story of Job is the story of this guy that's really holy and really loves God. And Satan, the devil, basically says, you know what? He only loves you because, you know, you bless him so much, right? I'm butchering it, okay? But it's the essential idea. And Satan says, you know what? And God's like, okay, fine. You know, we'll take it away. We'll take it away. And you'll see, Job will honor me. And in the story, you see Job loses everything, his family, his kids, his wealth, his everything that he has secured, his physical health is lost, everything's gone. And Job, even his friends turn on him and accuse him and say, you must have done something wrong, and call him out for all these things he didn't do and assume him everything. And yet, in the story, Job keeps going to God to the point that at the end of the story, he ends up trusting God still and honoring God. And things flip around, of course, but you know, it's a story that can be very discouraging. It can be, like, shattering. And it could have been meant for evil. Satan could have used that story to, like, discourage others. But if you've ever read the story of Job and you've gone through illness or struggle, it becomes a story of encouragement, a story of great hope. And for me personally, it has been one of my most comforting books to read. And my point of saying this is that maybe it was purpose for evil, but often God will make it for good. And this takes me then to also the story of Jesus. When you look at the story of Jesus, it's a story of a guy that's doing a lot of good things. He's helping people. He's healing people. He's challenging kind of things. He's helping alleviate sufferings. And yet in the middle of the status quo, he gets murdered. He gets falsely accused, falsely tried, and he gets murdered. So what possibly good could happen when a person who is good gets murdered for something that he didn't do, right? And what we learn as we understand the scriptures, as we understand the Bible, is that in all the great evil, all the injustices, if Jesus goes and dies for all those things, by dying for all those things, a greater good happens through his resurrection, through his sacrifice, right? That ultimately, by Jesus dying, it actually serves a greater good. It saves this world from our sins. And that's how maybe something looks evil, bad, it can turn out ultimately for God's glory and his good, okay? So my first point of saying is that we don't always see the circumstance. We don't see everything. But often in the storms, they are ways that God ultimately will still bring about his good, okay? My second point, though, is that but there's a personal element to it, that in the storms of our lives, often it's the personal part is that our storms shape our hearts. It shapes our hearts. It changes the way we think of things. And I think as when Paul was going through, when Luke were going through the storms, the verse that kept coming to me was this verse that came from Luke chapter 21, which is this verse that says, and it's in Luke chapter 21, it says that, it's this text where Jesus is being asked about what's going to happen, right? And Jesus predicts and shares to the audience, to the people, is that you're going to get persecuted, okay? And at the very end he says, you will be hated by all for my name's sake. Even your family will betray you. You'll be thrown and brought in front of like kings and governors. But not a hair of your head will ever perish. Because by your endurance, you will have your lives. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. And that word lives here, I want you to understand, is very special. Because that word for lives is the word in Greek, psyche, for soul. Okay? And it kind of ties to the idea that whatever makes you live, whatever will make you live. And often, I think, when we hit a storm in our lives, what happens is it shows you what you really value, right? When you go through something hard, your true colors often show. Not only your true colors, but your true values. Because you can't keep your act together when you're angry, hurt, scared, freaking out. When you're freaking out, you're not probably thinking normally, right? So who you really are bubbles forth. You can be at church and act and say the right thing, okay? But when you encounter a hardship and you get scared for a moment, those are moments where often who you really are comes out. And I think that's what happens when you're put into a situation like a storm, okay? Because I think that's what you realize what really matters to you. When you go through something serious, a hardship, then you have to ask yourself, what is important, right? And whatever that is, that owns your soul. That owns your soul. That owns your life. That's what gives you life, okay? And I think if it's your job, okay, or it's a relationship, okay, for some of us, it's the other person, okay? Maybe it's a want to have something, maybe coveting wealth, maybe hobby or passion. What happens if you are faced with a moment when you may lose it? What happens when you're going to lose it? How will you feel? I tell you, if everything is on your job and you lose it, you're going to feel pretty terrible. You're going to feel lost. You're going to feel shipwrecked, right? If you're in a storm in a relationship and you crash, you lose that person, what happens? And in the relationship part, you guys have heard my story. I've experienced that personally, right? But what if you lose something you've always had confidence in, like your health, right? How will you respond? Will you feel terrible? Because whatever is more important to you in those moments are often what you value the most in health. That possesses your heart and your soul, okay? And if it's anything but God, I'll tell you, you will always be dictated by those things in your life. So if your job goes well, you feel good that week. If your job doesn't go well, not so good. You're in a relationship, your girlfriend gets mad at you, or your husband or your wife gets mad at you, your life feels terrible. If it's your children, you feel terrible if they're not doing well. It just shows that you are being tossed to and fro, dictated in the storm of your life by that thing. That's what dictates your life. You see what I'm saying? And it happens to all of us. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. But Paul here in the middle of it. He has level-headedness. He can't do that. And he's able to say, you know what, let's take a moment. We need to all stay together. I don't know if he's fully calm, but he seems pretty calm when he's making these commands. We need to all stick together. Cut the boat off, right? He's making some big calls. And this leads me then to show you that there's an element of peace that happens within the storm. And what happens here is that often in suffering, you can have two responses. You can often be very bitter and self-pitying, which some people go through. When people go through hard stuff, it's not always a positive response, okay? But some people come out of it with bitterness and self-pity. But if you go into it and you realize there's something that is forming you and shaping you, it could be something that makes you grow and be better. And so you have to ask yourself, how does Paul have such a peace of mind? He says, you know what, guys? You haven't ate it in a while. Let's eat. I mean, you got to think about it. They're panicking. They're freaking out. They just cut the last possible escape, right? And they're probably going to crash. He's like, wait a second. We're not going to crash. Just eat some bread. I would not have a stomach to eat anything under duress, okay? But for some reason, Paul decides to give thanks to God, and he breaks bread. And some people said, wow, that's really interesting. Why does he sit there and he's like, let's have a feast? I don't know. Have you ever stressed out and not wanted to eat, right? I have. And I can't eat. My appetite gets really weird lately. And so somehow, in the midst of it, Paul finds a great peace of mind to just eat in fellowship. And says, don't worry, things will be fine. And I think that's something that is incredibly special. And if you read later in Rome, that he's in Rome, he writes a letter. And so one of the letters that has really helped me in this season of my life. So Job has helped me a lot. And then the other text that's really helped me is Philippians chapter 4. And the reason why Philippians is because Paul's in prison, this great missionary, and he can't do anything. He can't do anything. And he writes these verses at the very end of Philippians. He says, now that I'm speaking of being in need, for I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound. And I know how to abound. And in any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty. And hunger, and abundance, and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And often this is misused by a lot of people. And he goes, and I think at the end of it, he says, I know there's a secret, right? I have, let me see, did I not write it down? But anyways, this verse, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. He says, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance, and need. And I think that's really interesting. What is that secret that he knows that others don't know that gives him such a peace of mind to face everything? And I think the reality is that we face storms all the time. And there are storms that we face that we don't deserve. They're often out of our control, which is often what happens. But there is a storm that we face always in our lives that we must face one day. And that's ultimately God's call and judgment on us. And I think in that, facing that storm, Paul knows, and the greatest thing is that his secret is that, you know what? I have Christ. I have Christ with me as I travel through this journey. I'm not alone, ever. Okay, I'm never alone in my faith. That I am always have someone that is accompanying me, walking with me. And we will all face storms. And I think when you go through suffering, what is one thing that matters more to you? Does it matter to you if I come to you? Okay, I don't know if you guys ever had this happen, but if you're going through hard stuff, do you really want to have someone sit there with you and go, hey, you know what? Let me tell you why you're suffering. Do you really want to hear that? No, you probably don't want to hear why, right? You probably also don't want to hear Bible verses. You don't want people to tell you, you know what? If you knew Jesus' Bible better, you feel better. You don't want to hear that either, right? Nothing really helps, okay? I'll tell you what really helps. When people are going through hardship or suffering or any sort of pain, the best thing you can do is be present with people. It's presence. Why? Because presence shows you're there. You're physically present, enduring that discomfort with them. You might not feel pain. You might not even have the words to say, but you're there. You're feeling them. You're sitting there with them. They know you're there acknowledging them. They're not alone. Do you know what I'm saying? It matters to me to spend time with you guys because as I've gone through cancer, the most loneliest moments, it's been those little texts, those little messages that usually drive me nuts, but people are asking the same question over and over, but then I realize they care. They want to be part of my journey. People buying the Conquer Cancer shirt, they're just being part of the story with me. Those that come just pray for me, they're always being present with me. It means more than anything that you're walking with me through this. And I know that That means so much more to people when they're going through hardship. They don't need to hear theology at that point, right? It's helpful at times, but not that moment. But what's satisfying is that presence, that comfort. And what I want to show you today, and say at the very end, is this. You are never alone when you're going through the storms of your life. You are never alone because you have Jesus. Because only in the Christian faith, okay, and I'm not trying to attack other faiths. That's not my point. I'm saying, is there a God that says that you have a Savior that will suffer, that has suffered for you? Not only suffer with you, he understands your suffering. He knows your pain. He physically, as a human being, experienced a storm far greater than ours, and that he's walked in that storm before. Now I'm going to ask you some questions. Have you lost someone you loved? Have you lost someone maybe through miscarriage, through a loss of a death, tragically? Have you been betrayed by those that you trust the most, that you care about, that you value them, and you've been betrayed by them? Have you ever experienced great pain and suffering? Have you faced hardship of financial reasons or hunger or even poverty, like just having no money at all? Have you faced even perhaps death at one moment in your life? And I want to say this. Our God says, yes, I know how that feels. Jesus says, I know, I've been there. I've experienced all those things. And this is the God that has walked into the storms of our lives and died for us. And he knows our pain, and he loves us so much. When you're going into your, whatever things you're going through, maybe this is not something for today, maybe it's something for tomorrow, maybe some of you are going through something really difficult. I share this with you guys today because this is the way you're probably going to think. You're going to think, how much is God doing this, and how much is my role in this, right? But you're going to see, is like, is this so ultimately for God's good? I don't see how God's good is happening in my suffering and cancer. I don't, right? It hinders me from doing a lot of things. But in the grand scheme, I see God teaching me so much. And that's why I feel rejoicing. I rejoice a lot about my cancer. And people ask me, I always say, I do feel pretty blessed right now. I'm scared of chemo, okay? I hate the feeling. But my mom goes to church. She never went to church before. I message her and we go, let's talk about the text you're studying this week. Let's sit down and pray together. You know, my mom and I never have this conversation for 20, 30, 37 years, you know, 38 years. She's finally doing it. And it's like an answered prayer for 15 years. Because of it, I learned how to cook. I learned to live with someone I couldn't stand, my mom. So I feel like I'm ready to get married, too. I was like, oh, man, God's good. Right? All this must have a plan. All has a plan. And then I never felt alone. I never felt alone. If I've never felt loved by this church, it changed when I'm going to cancer because everyone has been praying and loving me in such small ways, and it means the world to me. I'm so grateful for this body. I'm never alone. And then the greatest comfort is I know that my God has walked with me through this every step of the way, that he's experienced my pain before. Some different form maybe, but it's the same hurt and loneliness, and yet he never left me. He's always been with me. And so what storm you face, whatever it may be, I hope that you experience that. That in the midst of the storm, there's a God that walks with you, that has faced this experience. And how will you respond then? Do you see it for his good? Do you see that it will shape you to become who you are called to be? I think it will. Let's pray.